Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. It is marvelous, magnificent Monday morning, March 12th, 2012. It's a great day to be alive. Welcome to the call. Thank you for being up and being alive and awake and aware and enthusiastic on this wonderful Monday morning. We are going to jump right into the content of the call. We're going to cover one of the most fascinating stories I probably have ever run across in my entire life, and it's another illustration of what the power, the mysterious power of desire, has the potential of doing in our lives. And it's entitled Desire Outwits Mother Nature. This is the conclusion of the chapter on desire in the book Think and Grow Rich. So here we go. As a fitting climax to this chapter, I wish to introduce one of the most unusual persons I have ever known. I first saw him 24 years ago, a few minutes after he was born. He came into the world without any physical sign of ears, and the doctor admitted when pressed for an opinion that the child might be deaf and mute for life. I challenged the doctor's opinion. I had the right to do so. I was the child's father. I too reached a decision and rendered an opinion, but I expressed the opinion silently in the secrecy of my own heart. I decided that my son would hear and speak. Nature could send me a child without ears, but nature could not induce me to accept the reality of the affliction. In my own mind, I knew that my son would hear and speak. How? I was sure there must be a way, and I knew I would find it. I thought of the words of the immortal Emerson, "The whole course of things goes to teach us faith. We need only obey. There is guidance for each of us, and by lowly listening we shall hear the right word." The right word? Desire. More than anything else, I desired that my son should not be a deaf mute. From that desire, I never receded, not for a second. Many years previously, I had written, "Our only limitations are those we set up in our own minds." For the first time, I wondered if that statement were true. Lying on the bed in front of me was a newly born child without the natural equipment of hearing. Even though he might hear and speak, he was obviously disfigured for life. Surely this was a limitation which that child had not set up in his own mind. What could I do about it? Somehow I would find a way to transplant into that child's mind my own burning desire for ways and means of conveying sound to his brain without the aid of ears. As soon as the child was old enough to cooperate, I would fill his mind so completely with a burning desire to hear that nature would, by methods of her own, translate it into physical reality. All this thinking took place in my own mind, but I spoke of it to no one. Every day I renewed the pledge I had made to myself, not to accept a deaf mute for a son. As he grew older and began to take notice of things around him, we observed that he had a slight degree of hearing. When he reached the age when children usually began talking, he made no attempt to speak, but we could tell by his actions that he could hear certain sounds slightly. That was all I wanted to know. I was convinced that if he could hear even slightly, he might develop still greater hearing capacity. Then something happened which gave me hope. It came from an entirely unexpected source. We bought a Victrola. When the child heard the music for the first time, he went into ecstasies and promptly appropriated the machine. He soon showed a preference for records. Among them, "It's a Long Way to Tipperary." On one occasion, he played that piece over and over for almost 2 hours, standing in front of the Victrola with his teeth clamped on the edge of the case. The significance of this self-formed habit of his did not become clear to us until years afterward, for we had never heard of the principle of bone conduction of sound at that time. Shortly after he appropriated the Victrola, I discovered that he could hear me quite clearly when I spoke with my lips touching his mastoid bone or at the base of the brain. These discoveries placed in my possession the necessary media by which I began to translate my reality into reality, my burning desire to help my son develop hearing and speech. By that time, he was making stabs at speaking certain words. The outlook was far from encouraging, but desire backed by faith knows no such word as impossible. Having determined that he could hear the sound of my voice plainly, I began immediately to transfer to his mind the desire to hear and speak. I soon discovered that the child enjoyed bedtime stories, so I went to work creating stories designed to help him in self-reliance, imagination, and a keen desire to hear and to be normal. There was one story in particular which I emphasized by giving it some new end and dramatic coloring each time it was told. It was designed to plant in his mind the thought that his affliction was not a liability but an asset of great value, despite the fact that all the philosophy I had examined clearly indicated that every adversity brings with it the seed of an equivalent advantage. I must confess that I had not the slightest idea how this affliction could ever become an asset. However, I continued my practice of wrapping that philosophy in bedtime stories, hoping that the time would come when he would find some plan by which his handicap could be made to serve some useful purpose. Reason told me plainly that there was no adequate compensation for the lack of ears and natural hearing equipment. Desire, backed by faith, pushed reason aside and inspired me to carry on. As I analyze the experience in retrospect, I can see now that my son's faith in me had much to do with the astounding results. He did not question anything I told him. I sold him the idea that he had a distinct advantage over his older brother, and that this advantage would reflect itself in many ways. For example, the teachers in school would observe that he had no ears, and because of this, they would show him special attention and treat him with extraordinary kindness. They always did. His mother saw to that by visiting the teachers and arranging with them to give the child the extra attention necessary. I sold him the idea, too, that when he became old enough to sell newspapers, his brother had already become a newspaper merchant, he would have a big advantage over his brother for the reason that people would pay him extra money for his wares because they could see that he was a bright, industrious boy, despite the fact that he had no ears. We could notice that gradually the child's hearing was improving. Moreover, he had not the slightest tendency to be self-conscious because of his affliction. When he was about 7, he showed the first evidence that our method of servicing his mind was bearing fruit. For several months, he begged for the privilege of selling newspapers, but his mother would not give her consent. She was afraid that his deafness made it unsafe for him to go on the street alone. Finally, he took matters into his own hands. One afternoon, when he was left at home with the servants, he climbed through the kitchen window, shinned to the ground, and set out on his own. He borrowed 6 cents in capital from the neighborhood shoemaker, invested it in papers, sold out, reinvested, and kept repeating until late in the evening. After balancing his accounts and paying back the 6 cents he had borrowed from his banker, he had a net profit of 42 cents. When we got home that night, we found him in bed asleep, with the money tightly clenched in his hand. His mother opened his hand, removed the coins, and cried. Of all things, crying over her son's first victory seemed so inappropriate. My reaction was the reverse. I laughed heartily, for I knew that my endeavor to plant in the child's mind an attitude of faith in himself had been successful. His mother saw in his first business venture a little deaf boy who had gone out in the streets and risked his life to earn money. I saw a brave, ambitious, self-reliant little businessman whose stock in himself had been increased 100% because he had gone into business on his own initiative and had won. The transaction pleased me because I knew that he had given evidence of a trait of resourcefulness that would go with him all through life. Later events proved this to be true. When his older brother wanted something, he would lie down on the floor, kick his feet in the air, cry for it, and get it. When the little deaf boy wanted something, he would plan a way to earn the money, then buy it for himself. He still follows that plan. Truly, my own son has taught me that handicaps can be converted into stepping stones on which one may climb towards some worthy goal, unless they are accepted as obstacles and used as alibis. The little deaf boy went through the grades, high school and college, without being able to hear his teachers, excepting when they shouted loudly at close range. He did not go to a school for the deaf. We would not permit him to learn the sign language. We were determined that he should live a normal life and associate with normal children, and we stood by that decision, although it cost us many heated debates with school officials. While he was in high school, he tried an electrical hearing aid, but it was of no value to him, due, we believe, to a condition that was disclosed when the child was six by Dr. J. Gordon Wilson of Chicago, when he operated on one side of the boy's head and discovered that there was no sign of natural hearing equipment. During his last week in college, 18 years after the operation, something happened which marked the most important turning point of his life. Through what seemed to be mere chance, he came into possession of another electrical hearing device, which was sent to him on trial. He was slow about testing it due to his disappointment with a similar device. Finally, he picked up the instrument and more or less carelessly placed it on his head, hooked up the battery, and lo, as if by a stroke of magic, his lifelong desire for normal hearing became a reality. For the first time in his life, he heard practically as well as any person with normal hearing. God moves in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. Overjoyed because of the changed world which had been brought to him through his hearing device, he rushed to the telephone, called his mother, and heard her voice perfectly. The next day, he plainly heard the voices of his professors in class for the first time in his life. Previously, he could hear them only when they shouted at short range. He heard the radio. He heard the talking pictures. For the first time in his life, he could converse freely with other people without the necessity of their having to speak loudly. Truly, he had come into possession of a changed world. We had refused to accept nature's error, and by persistent desire, we had induced nature to correct that error through the only practical means available. Desire had commenced to pay dividends, but the victory was not yet complete. The boy still had to find a definite and practical way to convert his handicap into an equivalent asset. Hardly realizing the significance of what had already been accomplished, but intoxicated with the joy of his newly discovered world of sound, he wrote a letter to the manufacturer of the hearing aid, enthusiastically describing his experience. Something in his letter, something perhaps which was not written on the lines, but back of them, caused the company to invite him to New York. When he arrived, he was escorted through the factory, and while talking with the chief engineer, telling him about his changed world, a hunch, an idea, or an inspiration, call it what you wish, flashed into his mind. It was this impulse of thought which converted his affliction into an asset, destined to pay dividends in both money and happiness to thousands for all time to come. The sum and substance of that impulse of thought was this. It occurred to him that he might be of help to the millions of deafened people who go through life without the benefit of hearing devices, if he could find a way to tell them the story of his changed world. Then and there, he reached a decision to devote the remainder of his life to rendering useful service to the hard of hearing. For an entire month, he carried on an extensive research, during which he analyzed the entire marketing system of the manufacturer of the hearing device and created ways and means of communicating with the hard of hearing all over the world for the purpose of sharing with them his newly discovered changed world. When this was done, he put in writing a 2-year plan based upon his findings. When he presented the plan to the company, he was instantly given a position for the purpose of carrying out his ambition. Little did he dream when he went to New York that he was destined to bring hope and practical relief to thousands of deafened people who, without his help, would have been doomed forever to deaf mutism. Shortly after he became associated with the manufacturer of his hearing aid, he invited me to attend a class conducted by his company for the purpose of teaching deaf mutes to hear and to speak. I had never heard of such a form of education, therefore I visited the class, skeptical but hopeful that my time would not be entirely wasted. Here I saw a demonstration which gave me a greatly enlarged vision of what I had done to arouse and keep alive in my son's mind the desire for normal hearing. I saw deaf mutes actually being taught to hear and to speak through application of the selfsame principle I had used more than 20 years previously in saving my son from deaf mutism. Thus, through some strange turn of the wheel of fate, my son Blair and I have been destined to aid in correcting deaf mutism for those as yet unborn, because we are the only living human beings beings, as far as I know, who have established definitely the fact that deaf-mutism can be corrected to the extent of restoring to normal life those who suffer with this affliction. It has been done for one, it will be done for others. There is no doubt in my mind that Blair would have been a deaf-mute all his life if his mother and I had not managed to shape his mind as we did. The doctor who attended at his birth told us confidentially the child might never hear or speak. A few weeks ago, Dr. Irving Voorhees, a noted specialist on such cases, examined Blair very thoroughly. He was astounded when he learned how well my son now hears and speaks, and said his examination indicated that theoretically the boy should not be able to hear at all. But the lad does hear, despite the fact that the x-ray pictures show there is no opening in the skull whatsoever from where his ears should be to the brains. When I planted in his mind the desire to hear and talk and live as a normal person, there went with that impulse some strange influence which caused nature to become bridge builder and span the gulf of silence between his brain and the outer world by some means which the keenest medical specialists have not been able to interpret. It would be sacrilege for me to even conjecture as to how nature performed this miracle. It would be unforgivable if I neglected to tell the world as much as I know of the humble part I assumed in the strange experience. It is my duty and a privilege to say I believe, and not without reason, that nothing is impossible to the person who backs desire with enduring faith. Verily, a burning desire has devious ways of transmuting itself into physical equivalent. Blair desired normal hearing. Now he has it. He was born with a handicap which might easily have sent one with a less defined desire to the street with a bundle of pencils and a tin cup. That handicap now promises to serve as the medium by which he will render useful service to many millions of hard of hearing. Also, to give him useful employment at adequate financial compensation the remainder of his life. The little white lies I planted in his mind when he was a child by leading him to believe his affliction would become a great asset, which he could capitalize, has justified itself. Verily, there is nothing right or wrong which belief plus burning desire cannot make real. These qualities are free to everyone. In all my experience in dealing with men and women who had personal problems, I never handled a single case which more definitely demonstrates the power of desire. Authors sometimes make the mistake of writing of subjects of which they have but superficial or very elementary knowledge. It has been my good fortune to have had the privilege of testing the soundness of the power of desire through the affliction of my own son. Perhaps it was providential that the experience came as it did, for surely no one is better prepared than he to serve as an example of what happens when desire is put to the test. If Mother Nature bends to the will of desire, is it logical that mere men can defeat a burning desire? Strange and imponderable is the power of the human mind. We do not understand the method by which it uses every circumstance, every individual, every physical thing within its reach as a means of transmuting desire into its physical counterpart. Perhaps science will uncover this secret. I planted in my son's mind the desire to hear and speak as any normal person hears and speaks. That desire has now become a reality. I planted in his mind the desire to convert his greatest handicap into his greatest asset. That desire has been realized. The modus operandi by which this astounding result was achieved is not hard to describe. It consisted of three very definite facts. First, I mixed faith with the desire for normal hearing, which I passed on to my son. Second, I communicated my desire to him in every conceivable way available through persistent, continuous effort over a period of years. Third, he believed me. As this chapter was being completed, news came of the death of Madame Schumann-Heink. One short paragraph in the news dispatch gives the clue to this unusual woman's stupendous success as a singer. I quote the paragraph because the clue it contains is none other than desire. Early in her career, Madame Schumann-Heink visited the director of the Vienna Court Opera to have him test her voice, but he did not test it. After taking one look at the awkward and poorly dressed girl, he exclaimed, none too gently, "With such a face, and with no personality at all, how can you ever expect to succeed in opera? My good child, give up the idea, buy a sewing machine, and go to work. You can never be a singer." Never is a long time. The director of the Vienna Court Opera knew much about the techniques of singing. He knew little about the power of desire when it assumes the proportion of an obsession. If he had known more of that power, he would not have made the mistake of condemning genius without giving it an opportunity. Several years ago, one of my business associates became ill. He became worse as time went on and finally was taken to the hospital for an operation. Just before he was wheeled into the operation room, I took a look at him and wondered how anyone as thin and emaciated as he could possibly go through a major operation successfully. The doctor warned me that there was little, if any, chance of my ever seeing him alive again, but that was my doctor's opinion. It was not the opinion of the patient. Just before he was wheeled away, he whispered feebly, "Do not be disturbed, Chief. I will be out of here in a few days." The attending nurse looked at me with pity, but the patient did come through safely. After it was over, his physician said, "Nothing but his own desire to live saved him. He never would have pulled through if he had not refused to accept the possibility of death." I believe in the power of desire backed by faith because I have seen this power lift men from lowly beginnings to places of power and wealth. I have seen it rob the grave of its victims. I have seen it serve as the medium by which men staged a comeback after having been defeated in 100 different ways. I have seen it provide my own son with a normal, happy life, successful life, despite nature's having sent him into the world without ears. How can one harness and use the power of desire? This has been answered through this and the subsequent chapters of this book. This message is going out to the world at the end of the longest and perhaps most devastating depression America has ever known. It is reasonable to presume that the message may come to the attention of many who have been wounded by the depression, those who have lost their fortunes, others who have lost their positions, and great numbers who must reorganize their plans and stage a comeback. To all these, I wish to convey the thought that all achievement, no matter what may be its nature or its purpose, must begin with an intense, burning desire for something definite. Through some strange and powerful principle of mental chemistry, which she has never divulged, nature wraps up in the impulse of strong desire that something which recognizes no such word as impossible and accepts no such reality as failure. Quite an amazing story here, my friends, and as Napoleon summed up this chapter, the most amazing part is the absolute fact that each of us listening to these words has the ability to utilize this incredible power of desire backed by faith to bring miracles into our lives. And that being said, I'm anxious to hear what everyone on the line is pulling from this story today and have a little bit of discussion. So I am going to open up the lines. Give me just one moment here. Star 6 to unmute your line, please.
Hey, Paul.
Good morning, Mr. Melvin Shaw. Great to hear your voice.
Oh, great to be here. You know, one of the things that I was getting from that, and it's something I think we just have to keep in mind, is that we might be highlighting the word desire, but none of these words stand on their own. I heard you mention back by faith, so, you know, the story consisted of desire, determination, faith, commitment, courage, hard work, and I guess that's one of the things I want to say we need to realize is that it's a combination of all of these things that come together that make it all happen. And so if any of us see ourselves not accomplishing or achieving what we hope to, and it's lacking one of those ingredients, then that's something just to take in consideration. Back to you, Paul.
Great points, my friend, as always, Melvin. Very well said. There are many pieces to the puzzle of success, and this is but the starting point. So, yeah, I appreciate you pointing that out. Desire and faith.
Good morning.
Good morning. Is that Rick?
Richard here from California.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, guys. I mean, Paul, man, you're consistent. I mean, in the mornings, I mean, you know, the lessons are not even just reading the book. The lessons are being shown from people in attendance. I mean, it's happening right here on the calls in such an amazing way. And you know, it's your ability to inspect and to take more notice of what's actually occurring around you. And look for these things. These little things right here is proof positive, you know. Sometimes you might get up into some academic preachment or whatever it may be, but just look for the little thing that's happening around you, because it's so important. You can tell on the calls that everybody is growing. You can see the little things happening, you know. And I want to bring you guys to the attention of when Napoleon, in his introduction in this book, he talks a lot about it's not necessarily the people who are working hard, but it has a lot to do with the thoughts and the mastermind, and not trying to do everything all by yourself. You know, you see, desire, when you have a desire, burning desire, and that's, you know, what think about it. When your back is up against the wall, you could be struggling for 20, 30 years, okay? And this is so important, because we've seen it happen time and time again with people. And then all of a sudden, something, it could be indignation, whatever the case may be, and they're sick and tired, become sick and tired, and overnight, it's not 20 years, it's in months, 16, 17 months. I've seen it, Paul, you and I, we know people. Mark Overson, for example, he lived in Trailer Park. He qualified for food stamps. One day his wife said, "Go out and make us some money." They start talking about the payment. Oh, you know, you can't get your hair done this weekend or whatever it is. And she just at one point just said, "Believe in him," and said, "Just go out and make us some money." Next you know, in 4 years he's making eight figures. That's not 40 years. That's in years, just a few handful of years. It can be done. So that burning desire you're talking about, you know something? It will, if you're looking for something, it will get, the resources will come into you if you are persistent on your burning desire and believe in it. That belief and desire will help you cultivate it, things that you never thought possible. And it's like Napoleon Hill said, there's something outside of us that's happening that we don't know. Something outside of us, similar to adrenaline. You surprise yourself, you may pick up something or do something you never thought possible. I picked up a car off my chest one time, pretty much. And it's crazy, but things happen and you don't know. It's something you could be trying for 20 years and never be able to do it. So let me tell you this. There's some, you know, don't limit yourself to just what you believe or your experiences are. There's other things that are at working out there. We not necessarily may understand it, but we can use it. Pretty much that's all I have to say this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Great comments as always. And I love how you pointed out that there seems to be a power outside of ourselves. Many times when I try to explain to people what happened to me over the last couple of years when I started following these principles, I use the word miracle many times to describe it. And people are like, well, there's no miracles. You know, there are miracles. Everything operates according to law. And I do believe that everything operates according to law, but there are laws that we don't see, and there are even some laws that we don't understand. And faith, I do believe, is an actual power that will cause things to happen outside of us It'll bring people into our lives, circumstances, businesses. A true faith will cause things to happen that do absolutely seem to be miraculous, because they are not sometimes the direct result of things that we can see with our own eyes. So great comments, Rick. Appreciate that. Star 6, who's next? Lot to pull out of this chapter.
Paul,
John from Chicago.
Yeah, Paul, thank you, Paul. Rick Pelton from Florida, just thank you. This is something, Paul, I really needed this morning. I know Doc Fran's listening on the phone, and just want to say thanks here in Palmetto, Florida. Thanks. I needed that this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate you, and thanks for being on the call. John, go ahead, sir. John from Chicago.
Yeah, you know, the great thing I've got from this particular chapter is not only the burning desire, but it's the burning desire backed by faith. A lot of people always talk about, you know, what I'm going to do, I'm going to do this. But your actions determine your belief. We only act on things that we believe. You know, like I said, people say a lot of things, but you can always tell by how you act whether you believe what you say. And he had the burning desire, and then he acted on that desire. And because of that action, you know, nature had no choice but to obey that, because he acted in such a manner as if it was already done. Back to you.
Great, great, great point. He did act. And I think it's also important, John, to ask ourselves, what did he do? You know, what did he do to plant the desire and grow that desire in his son's mind? And it was repetition of thought. Every day he would tell him a story. He would whisper, you know, to the mat. He'd put his lips on his mastoid bone and try to implant those thoughts again and again and again and again. And that's a very important thing to note. And we're going to go into more of this, obviously, as we continue on with the book. You know, the next chapter is faith, visualization, belief, and attainment of desire. Napoleon's going to tell us exactly how to cultivate this desire in ourselves, but just the simple example we can pull from the story is repetition of thought. Repetition of thought. That is one way we definitely can cultivate desire in ourselves and others. So thank you, John. Appreciate that. Desire backed by faith, a key line. Every failure brings with it the seed of an equivalent advantage. Another key line. Is that a truth? Is that a belief that you want to have in your life? I'm reminded of a line Doc Fran mentioned the other day. All excuses are equal. Here's a young boy born without ears and the natural equipment for hearing. Boy, what an excuse that could have been for him. But what did he do? He turned it into a business success as a young boy and then again as an adult. All excuses are equal. Another powerful line. Star 6, who wants to jump out? Share your thoughts, please.
Hey, maybe too much TV, too much negative this weekend. We need to get rid of those weeds. Get out on out there. Come out. listen, you know, if nobody wants to talk, I'll talk. You know, you talk about thoughts, okay? And I thought about this on my drive, my three-hour drive to Button Willow and back this weekend. And I want to remind you that what I thought about, I put it into this place. Every thought is like a building block, a brick, if you will, okay? And you're trying to build a building with this block, and the more persistent your thoughts are on any idea that you have a burning desire for, you keep thinking about that repetition, and each repetition of those thoughts is another block, okay? You may have thought about something at some point in time, and there is that brick, that block, okay? And you just let it sit, but you don't think about it again. You don't have a burning desire, so it's just that block. It didn't go anywhere because it's energy. It's not destroyed, so it sits there. So every thought that you have, don't think that it goes away. Those thoughts are actually things, and they're there forever, but maybe not manifest into a physical form in the sense where it's practical, where you can apply and use it. But it's nonetheless there, and you can reactivate it at any point. But when you're consistent thought, you're putting those building blocks together, and then eventually come into your home or it becomes your vehicle or your child's education fund, something, whatever it is. If you think about it in that way, whether your thoughts are negative or positive, own them. Just you own them. And when you own them, you realize that, hey, you know what? I can fix it. I can change it. I can concentrate my thoughts no matter what on what I really, really want. I thought that was pretty cool. Are you there?
Appreciate you, Rick. Absolutely, yes.
Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. It's Doc Fran.
Good morning, Doc Fran. Such a pleasure to hear your voice.
You're very kind, and the feeling is mutual. This is a story that's so amazing on so many levels. I mean, if there's ever an ultimate denial of reality, this is the story. And if there's any story that can be the ultimate proof of the power of the principles that this book imparts, this is the story. And it's true, Napoleon Hill had the burning desire, and he completely ignored the reality of the situation and understood that he was truly putting his philosophy that beliefs and thoughts become things. The second part of the equation here was the child himself. That child never really developed a burning desire to hear. What he brought to the equation was unabided faith and trust. And he believed what he was hearing. He believed what his father was saying. And his belief in the outcome never wavered. And that is really another major key and message to take from this. And the last thing that struck me about this, this is an ultimate story to express the concept that we've talked about before, about faking it till you make it. The brain does not know the difference between fantasy and reality, because the brain conceives things in thought form or formless form. And so whatever you continually feed the brain becomes the belief pattern of that brain. And once the brain conceives a belief pattern, it will create that belief pattern in manifestation. So, again, just an amazing, amazing chapter in terms of understanding the true limitless power. And it is not unbelievable when one understands to their core that we are more than physical beings, that we do have limitless spiritual power at our disposal. We simply have never allowed ourselves to exercise it. Back to you, Paul.
Doc Fran, I love those thoughts and points that that you brought out there. One of the lines from the story, desire backed by faith pushes reason aside. He mentioned little white lies that he told his son, you know, and what you just shared, and also these particular thoughts in relation to the story, cause me to, you know, ask myself what is true, what is not true. Sometimes we look around in our physical world and we see circumstances, or we see whatever we see with our eyes and whatever we sense with our senses, we sense that to be the truth. But one thing that I think is important to realize is that truth, there's a definition of truth that I heard one time that I really like, and it says something to the effect of faith is belief in that which is true but not yet seen. Because there's all sorts of things that are true that are just not in existence yet. And that's where visualization and looking into the future and having that faith that something great is on its way, even though we can't see it yet, that's faith, and it's true, and it's believing in that which is true that we can't see, sometimes over-believing that which is maybe true that we can see. So really, really important distinction to make there.
If I can follow up on one thing that your words just recalled in me, I sent out an inspiration for the day recently, the gist of which was, when you want to help someone, if you come at that person from the viewpoint, the belief point, the thought or attitude of not identifying with their problem, but rather identifying with the solution that can be achieved by that person, you have effective interaction, effective communication. If Napoleon Hill had looked down at his son, who was clearly born with a major birth defect, and had allowed himself to go into grief, pity, sympathy, anger, fear, denial, all of the lower tone reactions that I think most parents would have at that situation, and immediately became sympathetic and pitying towards this poor child, the entire course of that child's life would have been altered to the negative. And how often do we do that when we see children with afflictions or adults with afflictions, and we go into pity for them as opposed to empowering them to overcome? This is going to be a really far out concept, but we create every event in our life, including our own selection of parents and our own way in which we are born into this world. So those individuals who either are born into the world that way or who create an event in their life to put themselves into the physical form that they need in their life, this lifetime, to fulfill their purpose and learn the lessons that they've come to this lifetime to learn, we don't help them by going into pity for them. We help them by staying in a positive frame of mind, understanding that that is, even if they don't understand that they've created this event to enable them to succeed, we're not doing a service to them to try and be sympathetic and pitying towards them. We only do a service when we stay at the higher level of consciousness and empower them to move to that level with you. Back to you.
I told Doc one time we were going to change the name of this call to Deep, 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 Deep Thoughts with Doc Fran.
I'm recording this call.
Yes, yes, glad we are recording it. Very powerful stuff there, Doc, and it kind of flies in the face of what we traditionally are taught, which is, well, you know, just let's have a pity party. Somebody's down and out, get down in their muck and wallow around with them and make them feel like, you know, you're there with them. And a certain amount of understanding is important, but I love what you just shared. Stay high tone, come from a position of solution. Just brilliant stuff. Thank you.
Hey, Paul, it's Dana in Arizona.
Hey, Dana. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, there are three types of adversities that Napoleon Hill is talking about in this segment. And one of them is kind of unspoken, and the other two have a visible content that you can actually see on the print. But the first one, the adversity that we run into, and I'm sure that he was running into as well, was an inward voice that was telling him that that could not be done. Because as he looked at the second thing, the outward circumstances seemed to be so poignant that there was just no way that this child was going to be able to hear. So by looking at the outward circumstances, That was the second battle that he was fighting. And then also he brings out in a couple of places the professional opinions of doctors, or in the case of the opera singer, the musician or the conductor, saying that they could not do that because they just weren't gifted, they didn't have the talent, they didn't know what they were doing. And so those are the three adversities that we go through all the time. And we've got an inward voice that is constantly telling us, what are you doing? You think you're going to do this? You know, you failed in so many other things. You cannot do this. And we have to battle that. We have to battle sometimes the professional opinions of other people who might even have a degree behind their name. And that is not to say anything bad about them, but many times the faith and the desire that he's talking about overcomes these circumstances and the opinions and the inward voice. And, you know, many times the outward circumstances, we're battling that all the time, you know, just trying to maintain our composure and keep that burning hot desire going. And I think that's what's important. Again, I just keep coming back to this, about that definite major purpose, is that when you do have setbacks, maybe you get a bad opinion from somebody, maybe you got an inward voice beating you up all day, maybe you've got outward circumstances that seem so dire that you don't think you're going to do it, you have to come back to that starting point each and every day. And I know that's why he's telling us to read that definite major purpose twice a day at least, and then your self-confidence formula at least once a day, because it restarts, if you're getting going on a downhill trend there, it restarts that burning heart, hot desire to get you going again, and then you will rise above, just like this young man did at the encouragement of his father, Napoleon Hill. They would not believe otherwise, and they were going to obtain success regardless of the circumstances around them. Back to you.
One of the reasons I love this call is because we have so many different perspectives and so many different eyes and so many different brains looking at the material that many times one of us will bring out something that the rest of us didn't see. And Dana, that this is a perfect, what you just shared is a perfect example of that. I love how you pointed out the three types of adversity that that were present in the content, and that absolutely each of us face on a daily basis. Thank you so much for that, and also for your beautiful illustration of the importance of the repetition of the daily major definite purpose and self-confidence formula. Awesome stuff. Really appreciate you, Dana.
Hey, Paul. It's Doc Fran again.
Yes.
Dana, that was brilliant. And it really, I'm going to tell a personal story that proves the point that Dana was making. And what Dana was speaking to is the agreements. And you know, I've mentioned agreements before. Be careful what agreements you make and go into, because that's what becomes your belief patterns, and that's what becomes the manifestations. In 1998, I lost the use of my right arm and had to go out of practice because I was a right-handed surgeon. And I was told at the time I had developed a condition called avascular necrosis, which is death of the bone from loss of the blood supply in all of my joints. And I was treated by John Hungerford, who is the world's authority on multifocal avascular necrosis. And my physicians could find no cause for why I had this AVN. They just knew that I had it. And their prescription for me was pain medications for the considerable pain and surgery. If I lived 3 years, I would have to have all of my joints replaced in my body. So I told them thank you, but no thank you. And I never went into agreement with that prognosis. And I went to a friend of mine that does alternative and nutritional medicine, and we very rapidly defined a cause for my problem, which my physicians never looked for, and it was mercury and heavy metal poisoning. And this was very consistent with my career. I had spent 25 years drilling out silver fillings in people to do rehabilitations. And so I had inhaled those aerosols and got mercury and heavy metal poisoning from that. So once we knew the cause, we knew a solution possibly. So we started on alternative medicine, and that's what led me into the last company before my current company that I joined 13 years ago. And what's beautiful, and the point of the story is, not only have I put avascular necrosis into full remission for 13 years, at the time that I was diagnosed, I was one of four people in the world who had advanced multifocal AVN. It is a chronic degenerative fatal problem. I'm the only person in the world who's ever arrested it. And I did it through supplementation and belief. And in the course of that, it also created a lot of the abundance in my life from what I gained through experiences in this industry, that company, and that experience. So, you know, don't always go into agreement with the opinions of your experts. Keep your own counsel. Maintain your own faith, maintain your own belief, and you can truly determine the outcome of your own life independent of what anyone else's opinion of it might be. Back to you, Paul.
Powerful. Thank you so much for sharing those experiences with us, Doc.
Wow, any we have other? Another dead spot?
No, not yet. I'm fine giving it a little bit longer. There wasn't too much dead spot there.
Okay, somebody coming out or what?
Let's somebody. Give them a little time. Hello, who's that? I heard a female voice.
Hi, it's Linda. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Linda.
I found it very fascinating to listen to everyone talk this morning, and it especially resonated in my spirit with the opinions of experts. And, you know, we respect professional opinions and what have you, but I so agree with the fact that we do have to take our own destiny into our own hands. And I think about Napoleon and his son, and despite what the experts were saying, the thing that in their minds, in the experts' mind, that could have helped his son, including the sign language, he refused to allow that because in his mind, I would think that he thought it would be a handicap to his son. And I just thought that was so fascinating. The very opposite was true. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Linda. Great comments there. And it is fascinating.
Paul?
Melvin, yes.
I think that's one of the most valuable things said today is what Doc and also the young lady that just spoke said. Is you've got to, and most of us have been taught not to truly understand and believe in yourself, in your own thoughts, and the power there, and we give that up to others. That's why, even though some people may disagree with me, I speak of the religion thing so often, is because so many of us, we buy into this is what our family did, and this is what was said, and this is what everybody else is doing, and we buy into that. And there's a lot of what we should maintain and keep ourselves that we give up, that we really sell ourselves out. And with that, back to you, Paul.
Appreciate that, Melvin. And, you know, that's one of the greatest gifts that I think that each of us can give to each other on the call is to come away from this experience we have together where we're learning and growing and learning how to control our own minds and thought processes with the ability to really think and trust ourselves and have faith in ourselves and use our own minds. Earl Nightingale in The Strangest Secret quoted a man named Dr. Albert Schweitzer, and I've mentioned Dr. Schweitzer a couple of times on this call, a fascinating man. I read a biography of his, just incredible what he did with his life. And somebody asked Dr. Schweitzer, who is a Nobel Prize winner, "Doctor, what's wrong with men today?" And the doctor was silent a moment, and then he said, "Men simply don't think." And that's hopefully what we can all give each other, is the ability to think, process our own minds, come to our own conclusions, and that's one of the greatest gifts that we can have on this earth, I believe. So beautifully illustrated by Doc, Fran, Linda, and Melvin. Good stuff. Who's next? Star Bill 6. Lynn. Hey, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. I've been listening here, and everything we've talked about, now you can hear all of the various philosophies and things we're doing, but we have to rely on ourselves to take our own actions. So many times, you know, we pray and says, "God, take care of us," and people think that God never said that. He said they help those who help themselves. And if we don't actually step out and move and take action on our own, nothing ever happens. But so many times we wait for other people to take action and we miss out. So I think it's so important that, you know, we can hear everything, write everything down, but if we don't personally put it into action, nothing happens. Back to you, Paul.
Great, great point, Bill. We are definitely the causative agents in our lives. That is a very powerful truth right there.
Good morning, Paul. It's Marlies.
Marlies, good morning.
I just wanted to also just add a little bit yet, or just confirm what everybody else has been saying. And I just really, really consider this to be the most powerful, incredible story of true faith. And putting into practice that Napoleon Hill has been conveying and teaching and writing about to the world, and actually he being put into that kind of position where he's being put to the test to really prove these principles to be true. So there's nothing more inspiring or more powerful than this particular story. Because as a parent, we know many parents who have a child. I also have a speech handicapped brother, where this definitely is being looked upon and has been looked upon as an affliction, and as, you know, really doing everything possible to kind of help that child, but not helping that child or that person in a positive way, the way Napoleon Hill has demonstrated to us. I mean, I'm just absolutely kind of blown away by that. I even had forgotten about that story when I've read it so many years ago. So truly this, I mean, every person, human being needs to hear that and understand it and just and actually really starting to totally not just understand, but really also put it into practice to really make a difference. And also what Dr. Fran had pointed out, I'm just reminded of a quote by that poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. And I cannot say it exactly, but what the gist of it is that the way that we treat a person is not the way that they come across, the way that he or she is, but the way this person is capable of becoming. Truly, as a child of God, we have just so much power within us. And if others really treat you that way, that you do have that power within yourself, then that other person wants to live up to that. And that's exactly what Napoleon Hill has instilled in this boy. So there was just no doubt, obviously, in the mind and the heart of Napoleon Hill that there must be a miraculous way that nature, that God can provide this kind of outcome, right? That inherently, this boy obviously never had, you know, any kind of doubt in his mind or heart. So it just had to come about. So what an illustration for Napoleon Hill to be put into a position to truly walk his talk and follow up on the faith that he has, that he's been wanting to instill and teach to, you know, millions, you know, around this world. Truly, absolutely remarkable. So that's all I wanted to add. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marlies. Always appreciate your comments. Anyone else? One final comment. We've got about 1 minute left.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, this is Cynthia from New York. So glad to be with you guys live. I've been taking action, so I've had to listen to the recording, so it's nice to be here with you live. And what I wanted to add to the conversation, or just emphasize, is the importance of that issue of attention. That is something that I am dealing with, working on, that the cares of this world, the cares of this life, dealing with family and work and all the other things we have to deal with, can really distract us. And the power in what we're learning, one of the keys to it is the amount of attention, mental attention that we give to our pursuit. So I would just encourage everybody to, you know, guard their minds, you know, guard what you take in, and guard what you allow to marinate in your mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia. Very, again, another very powerful point, truth, suggestion that we all should definitely follow. And I would encourage everyone, one of the ways that I've been marinating on some of this stuff is I have a notepad out while we're going through the call and I'm jotting down truths. And then when we get done, I go back through and then I pull out the real gems and write them down in my journal. And then in the evening time before I go to bed, I go back through those thoughts and try to do what Cynthia just shared, which is to marinate. Really, really great suggestion. Because as Rick shared with us before, reflection turns experience into insight. I think that's a powerful line. So that being said, my friends, I want to close out the call by thanking everybody and also by sharing with you one final quote. The task ahead of you is never as big or as great as the power behind you, and then I'm going to add this little caveat, if you understand the law and work with the law, and that is what we are attempting to do on this call every morning. So let's get out there today. Let's have faith. Let's realize that we can experience miracles in our lives if we will understand and apply the law, have faith, take action, be persistent, build our beliefs that are empowering, and let's make it a great day. And we'll come back tomorrow on the Think and Grow Rich call. Love each of you. Believe in you. Have faith in you. Take care.